Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDooley.
And I'm Bronwyn Ely.
And today we had the absolute pleasure of speaking to one of my all-time favourite authors ever since I was about 13 years old, Isabel Carmody.
Who is in to talk about her new book, The Ice Maze, which is the third in her The Kingdom of the Lost series, which is this gorgeous children's series about two brothers who go on perilous adventures and meet incredibly interesting characters. And it's alongside some very beautiful illustrations.
These books are gorgeous, which is no surprise to me because literally everything Isabel Carmody does, I love. Her books sort of shaped me since I was really young, and it's always such a pleasure to speak to her. And we covered a lot of ground in this podcast.
We did.
We learned about the joys of illustrating.
We learned about the art of kintsugi.
We took a brief visit to an Eastern European op shop.
There was a shout out to Stephen Hawking.
And Philip Pullman got a mention.
And at some point in there, we also discussed her new book, The Ice Maze.
So, are you ready for this much awesome?
Ready? Here we go.
Isabel, welcome. We are so excited to be here with you today. We being me, Sarah McDooley, and Bronwyn Ely. I am a long, long time fan of your books, and Bronwyn is just a newcomer.
I am a brand new fan, but I'm definitely a solid fan now after reading the series.
Well, thank you for having me back again.
Now, you're coming today because The Ice Maze is coming out.
Yes!
Can you tell, for anyone who's not familiar with this series, can you tell them just a little bit about it?
Okay, well, the story is about these two little guys who lived on a plane, and they lived this very simple life, and it's very hard for them. It's not easy. It's a very barren plane. And the two characters' names are Billy and Shluti. And Billy is very much has a garden, and he looks after the birds that come. He's a healer. And Shluti is this adventurous, brave brother who travels a very long way to get the things they need. And once a year, he makes this quite apocalyptic journey. And it's dangerous, it's very far. He has to prepare very well for it, to the northern forest. And one year when he's going, a stone storm comes, and it destroys their home. And from then on, they have to find a new home, a new place to build a home. But what they don't realise is that the stone storm is not natural, and there's reasons for the storm. And they begin to discover more about the world, and that they live this very simple life, but it's a very complicated world, and has a very complicated connection to these powerful beings called makers, who basically want to come and occupy this world and want to clear it away before they actually occupy it. So for them, it's a matter of moving through this world that they didn't know existed, through all these various situations, learning more and more about the makers as they go, and learning that they have a task that they will need to do to make their world safe. And so the third book is The Ice Maze. And so we've got to the point where they've reached this wall of mountains, and they can't get beyond the wall. They have to go around it. And this takes them into the icy land in the north. And so that's what they're heading towards. And they have to get around the end of the mountains so they can go west, which is where the Vale of Bellflowers is, where they will build a new home, they hope. So that's the story. It's a journey.
I feel like I'm going to ask you a million questions and Bronwyn won't have a chance to say anything, so I'm like pausing.
That is okay, that's okay.
May I?
Yes.
Okay. So we're at book three. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious about the makers and about how Shluti and Billy arrived in this world, this beautiful alien world full of things that are familiar and strange. And,
Yeah, I love everything that's metal in it. Every time I see it, especially in the illustrations, it just jogs something in my, obviously because it's familiar to us. And so I'm so curious to find out more about the makers, and every step of the way they're learning, and I'm just desperate to find out.
It's great.
Yeah,
so
it's done really well.
There's going to be another book after this one, and then how many will that be? The last one, do you know?
Well, yeah. I The Velvet City was originally going to write a trilogy, but then what happened with the monks on the mountain in the Cloud Road, I just thought, what happened to the female monks? Maybe there aren't any female monks. And I started to really, I had this vague notion that they were somewhere else and that something else was happening with them, and there was a reason those monks on the mountain were so hard and so awful. So then I started to think, well, what would happen? You separate, you know, the male from the female. What happens to the others? And why are they apart? And I had a really good idea about, when I started to think about it, I got really excited. It was quite a big idea. And I thought, I can't possibly fit it. I would either have to just have it as something I barely mention, or I really have to explore it. So I talked to my publisher, Laura, and I said, what do you think? And she said, well, do you want it to be another book? And I said, yes, I would love that. And she said that was okay. So then I was able to go there and explore that. In the books, there's two areas which we don't go to in the story as I've imagined it at the moment. But the more I write, the more longing I have to go to those places. There's the Southland. When they come to the Wall of Mountains, they go to the north. The south is rivers of fire and poisonous fumes. And I can just imagine, I can visually imagine that, mm-hmm. but we're not going there. And Red Wing, who's a very important character in the books, has flown through a flyway in the mountain, flies through the mountain to the west. And we don't know what happens to Red Wing. And I have a strong desire to take Billy and Jluti across the sea. And the only way I could do that is to go to where Red Wing goes. So there are possibilities. I can bring it all to a close at the end of the final book, but the more I think about it, the harder it is for me to not want to do that. So it could end in the next book.
But maybe. I speak for us. We'll be happy for many, many, many more books to come.
Yeah. So there's that. And it's, again, it's a question of then looking at the idea and thinking, is it full enough? Because if it's just a visual of one land, that's not enough. There has to be more. And it's really how to organise the final book. And when I got to the end of The Ice Maze, there's an element that happens towards the end where something very dramatic happens. And I wanted to have it happen in this book. I was going to have it happen in this book, something terrible, which is resolved at the beginning of the next book. But it got so big that I thought, actually, you know what, it's probably better to keep it as, you know, the beginning and end of that event can happen in the next book. But because that also moved into the final book, it made it bigger, which means the first section of the next book now needs to be to encompass that really exciting thing that happens. So I thought, okay, it's starting to get, anyway, I'm going to have a big conversation with the publishers. We're going to discuss this.
Well, every time I read one of your books, I always come away thinking about the world and the future in particular, and also animals and how we treat animals. I always come away with these really huge ideas, but also having fallen in love with just the characters and their story. Yeah. And I just wanted to talk to you about that, where your first spark of inspiration comes from. And is it, you know, you've got a beautiful story of two brothers here, and they're such like complex little characters. One seems to be brave and courageous, and one seems to be not brave
timid,
and lonely.
Yeah.
But then the further you go on with the story, the more they change layers of their character get revealed and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like that always with your characters. They're always complicated and deep and rich, and I'm just babbling.
No. You are such a deep reader. Seriously, you're such a deep reader because you just pick on the two most important things now for me, which is that a book should always be about what it's about. It should be the story, and that's what you should read when you read it. But of course, underpinning it is all the things I care about, like you said, like animal welfare. And one of the really strong underpinnings of that whole series for me, although you don't see it in the series, is the fact that how many times in life my daughter and I would see things, or I was with children and they would raise subjects like children who sleep on the ground in other countries, like refugee children, these kinds of things. And I'm very much interested in, you know, the welfare of people who we dismiss as almost like rubbish. Like we throw them away, we throw away our toys, we throw away people, we throw away cultures. And my feeling of how do children process that? Like my daughter didn't understand why, if I loved her and children have parents that love them, how come some parents don't love their children? How come some people don't look after other people? And they ask you those questions, and there's no way to have an answer because there is no answer we can offer. But you have to still have the conversation. You have to share your concern and your confusion with your children. And I feel like I wrote the whole little first series and all of these ones with the idea that they would be read aloud at some point, because I really love the sound of language, and I loved reading to my daughter, and I still read to her. She's 18, and from time to time she says, "Read to me, Mama," and I do. And I love it, and she loves it, but I think it's a really shared experience. And we used to discuss things after reading them, laying in the dark after the chapter was finished, while I would be stroking her head, and she would talk about whatever it was that troubled her. And many of those conversations you need to have with your child happen in the aftermath of a book. So your question, which you call babbling, was not babbling at all. It contains those two really important elements, which is... And that's the problem, I think, with a lot of writing. People write and they let the issue get in the way of the story. It's important to think about the world and to care about it. But when you write, you must give your allegiance to the story that you're writing. So that's not what the books are about, but it's very strongly underpinned by that. And that's, I think, where the layering of characters comes from. Yeah. It's because you reach deep down into yourself and those layers of your own concern about various things, your own our adult inability to solve these big philosophical questions and need to think about them penetrates the book and comes through in the layered characters too. So you nailed it.
I'd say you nailed it.
Yeah.
What's it like for you, because these books are aimed slightly more middle grade age reading level. Is it a different experience for you writing when you know the readers will be a little bit younger than some of your other books?
The truth is that I never think about the readers when I write, and I don't think about the age of them, but the characters themselves are the thing that shape the age of the readership, I think, because those characters somehow, although they're very old and they've lived for a long time, same with the Little Fur books, there's a child character there. Mm-hmm. So they are, to some extent, even though they're children, in some way, and so you capture that child language, and I think that dictates the readership rather than that I'm aiming. Because when people say, like, that term middle grade, someone said that to me the other day, and I said, what actually is that?
It's, you know, what age is it? Term,
it is.
Yeah, but I mean, what age does it actually mean? Because you can have a 9-year-old who will read something very sophisticated, and then you can. So the age factor is a bit complicated. So for me, it's always dictated by the character, and then I let the public. Well, they're the ones who will decide far better than me what the readership will be. And because that's a marketing question in some ways too.
It is, yeah. And it's hard. I mean, we're in the bookselling side of things, so we get so used to categorising books. But when it comes to my reading, I love to read a children's book. I love to read, all over the place. I don't restrict my own reading by age groups.
They do look like children. And yeah, you do get that impression at first that they're little boys, they're little brothers, but their experiences are not...
No.
Not for little children, like they're grown up, like they
and
live by themselves.
And you don't know how long they were living on the planet. Yeah. They seem sort of eternal.
I know, I'm trying really hard I'd like to avoid even to avoid questions, like, because I'm not always sure about how old they are, and it's not that relevant to me. But there is something you asked, if there's a different way that I write about it. I have to say that when I write through the mouth of a child, a character, a young character, a character that isn't human, like the Diggers, it means that you can do what children do, which is they're not stupid. A little child can see a murder and know it's a murder. They just don't understand quite what they're seeing, and they might not have the language for it, but they invent it. And what I love about writing these kind of books is that I'm free to invent language based on just what do you see? What could it be called? Whereas an adult will just simply know a name. So I love that formulation of idea and naming that children do. And I really love writing through the mouths and minds of these younger characters. And it was Greylands that I first did it in, when I came up with Jack and his little sister, and that language they had. And I realised for the first time that you don't write down. And I always thought that if I wrote for younger kids, I was asked to do it much earlier in my career, and I said, no, I don't know how to do that, I don't want to do that. But when I wrote through Jack and Ellen's minds, I realised that you don't write less, you actually just write differently, and it's poetic. It's beautifully poetic. You can invent language, you can play with the way things are said.
So, enchanting about reading these kinds of books.
Yeah.
The way the Diggers speak.
I love them. I know, I love them too.
And it rolls off the tongue as well. You think it wouldn't, but it does, and it just adds complete different meaning.
It's amazing what you do with language, the languages that you create for different types of people, like the animals in Over Newton and the different kinds of animals in this. Everyone has a voice. The she-monks are full of humour. I loved that they were just
liked the she-monks. Like, when I started to think about the she-monks, I just loved them so much. And I really loved drawing them. And you know those Japanese monkeys that sit in the water? Yeah. And I've always, yes, always loved those pictures so yes. much. And I'm looking forward to, with the next one, being allowed to spend, because people often think that when you get to the next book, you'll be moving on. But I pretty much always with books have a period in which the character is where they are for a while. Because if you like the last book, I always feel like I want a little bit of a taste of where they are. Before they move on again into the next thing. And that's with everything that I've ever written that's a sequel or a series. And with these, I know that I'm going to be in the ice and snow for a while.
Yeah.
And plus, I love being there. The and I love visualising. Yeah. Yes! Yes! Yeah, so there's all sorts of... And I love the monster and I love all the various kind of...
Oh, the monster's getting really interesting, actually, in this last book.
Yeah,
like, it's such a massive destiny and you're still not 100% sure what he's going to do or if it's going to be achieved.
Well, I think it's... I also felt like there are people who... Look at someone like Stephen Hawking. He spent his whole life in a wheelchair and in an increasingly tough situation. And that doesn't mean to say you can't do incredible things in the world. And so it was that thought of him being injured or disabled for a long period of time. But for him, it's not nothing happening. He's learning so much from what he was to begin with. So when he comes to the Velvet City, he's a lot of stuff that will happen with him is finalized in the Velvet City. And when we get there, you know, you realize that all that time in which he had no power and was literally powerless made him able to empathize to a far higher degree than he would otherwise have been able to do. So he was shaped and slightly different so that he would learn. And sometimes, what is it? You know, what's that? Is it kintsugi? That term, which is where it's a Japanese term for if something gets broken, they repair it with gold.
I've never heard of this.
Is it kintsugi? Something like that. And I can't remember what the term is. But
guess what? I'll be Googling.
Yeah.
That beautiful term. And he is that character. He's broken. And in the broken places is where the gold grows. And where all the strength of his character comes from the brokenness of him. And so. Wow.
You just have a way of actually giving me shivers when you talk.
Yeah.
Also, obviously, when you write.
And when you draw as well.
The
illustrations are beautiful.
You've illustrated these books.
Yeah.
What comes first? Do you write the story and then go back and do the illustrations, or is it a bit of both?
I want to say, first of all, that of all the things Penguin ever did for me in my life, letting me draw the first book of the Little First series was the biggest thing they ever did for me. It was the greatest pleasure of my life. And I'll never forget, whatever happens in the future, I'll never forget that they opened that up for me, because they could have just said no. I wrote to them and said, look, I've got this idea, but I want to draw it myself. That's the catch. And I sent them four drawings that I'd done with my daughter's $3 paint box of Little Fur and a couple of Fox and Little Fur and Crow and just Little Fur on her own. And I can't remember what sent them off. And they said yes. And it was because of that I started. I'd drawn all my life, but it was the first time. And they said yes. And they said, look, we'll expect about 70 drawings. And I thought, yes. And then I went home and thought, oh, my God, what have I done? I don't even know. Can I do this? And I was really, really frightened. So I did 120 drawings. And I did them as best I could over a year. And I thought, okay, now they'll have a choice, because I can't draw. So they'll pick the drawings they like the best. And they used all of them. And I was really shocked, because I didn't expect that. I thought that they would choose the best drawings. And when I brought them in that first day, their reaction was huge. And it was just such a great reaction. And I also remember that back when Penguin actually took the first drawings, they hadn't said yes or no, and we had a dinner. And I was just coming for drinks beforehand, and I'd sent them a yellow envelope, and Julie Watts had in her handbag the yellow envelope, and Bob Sessions said to me, so what are you doing now? And I saw her start to pull out this envelope, and at the table was Paul Jennings and a whole lot of illustrators, and I said, don't you dare, because no one had ever seen these, and I was really embarrassed that these little $3 paint box were there. And she gets them out, and as soon as I said, don't you dare, and she starts to put them back in, and Paul's wife Claire reached out and pulled them out of his hand, pulled them out of the paper and spread them across the page. And everyone went, that was this kind of like apocalyptic, oh my God, for me. And then their reaction was huge. Paul said, I don't even know if he remembers, but Paul said, well, I would write a story to go with those pictures. But their reaction was really big. And it was the first time I'd sort of really shown anybody anything. And I think that's later on, that reaction was probably why Penguin said yes, or no, they were prepared to say yes, but they just hadn't said it at that moment.
Yeah.
So that was all, you know, in that. And so that led me through to finishing the series and feeling really confident by the end of the series that I could draw for my own stories. And then I thought, well, they were really indulgent letting me do that. I'm so lucky. And then they asked me to about the illustrations for these ones. And I just thought, oh, they want them. It's okay. They actually would like them. So I illustrated them. And then the second one was, you know, one book of the year. And for me, that award, of all the awards that I've won, was huge because it incorporated the illustrations as well. So it was like a stamp of approval on them. So, but I don't write that I'm the illustrator on the front of the books anywhere, because I didn't train as an illustrator. I just drew a lot of time. And there's people out there who spent their lives honing their skills and that are truly brilliant at what they do. You know, we talked about Tove Jonsson before, who did the Mumintroll books, and her illustrations are exquisite. And I'm really inspired by her and Edward Gorey. Do you know his illustrations?
No.
Yeah, he's this strange guy who did these very retro-looking illustrations, great illustrations. Mm. And I like black and white illustrations, so that's where they came from. So I must say, I mean, the other pleasure of doing this series is being allowed to draw the illustrations. But you talked about the metal before.
Yeah,
the very first set of illustrations I did the illustrations and I cut out from a magazine just to the rough drawings. I cut out collages of bits of washing machines and bits of things to use as the metal things, just to send them the rough drafts of it. So it's funny that you should mention that before.
Yeah. Well, it's a strong visual.
They're absolutely, you know, stunning.
To be in what is a fantasy world and have recognisable flotsam and jetsam from our world is like, it's part of what I liked about Over Newton as well. You're in this world. It's so far removed from what we know as our world, but threaded throughout are all these things that we recognise and know.
Yeah.
It's my favourite type of fantasy. Fantasy that gets you to think about your world.
Definitely.
I loved it too. I really love those. I love apocalyptic landscapes for exactly that reason, because there's just this is it detritus? Detritus of our world.
I'm learning so many words.
I know.
Of our world just kind of laying around, and we don't know. Like, I want you always, as a writer, I think you're constantly trying to look at your own people and your own race in your own time. So stuff set in the future is always about now. And that's why you think of the future, because it's this building together of, so what will happen to us if we go on as we are, this kind of thing. And it allows you to look at your own world, and your fantasy does that better than anything else. It allows you to step back and look at how we are as human beings. What do we do? What don't we do? What do we do badly? What do we do beautifully? And it's one step removed. And so that bits and pieces, the very archaeological approach, because you have all this stuff and then people reading the story pick it up and try to put it together along with the character to figure out, so what did happen to those people? Like in the Over Newton Chronicles, there's a gap of time between the end of the our time and the beginning of the time of that Elspeth's living in. So there's a gap of time, but there's also a gap between the before time, which is when our world ended, and now. And the question is, what happened in that time? And our lesson is in there somehow. Yeah. And I don't know what that is, you know, where it went. But there's all these clues, which then I can, when I write the before time books, I can actually focus in on that then.
Before time books.
But that has to wait a while. So I need distance
Sarah
on that.
Sweeney.
I need distance.
I mean, I also think at everything of yours I've ever read, you really strike like with precision to what it means to be human, because always we're in these books, you've got these two little characters who aren't human in the way that we understand humanity,
no.
but who are on this adventure and meeting people and sort of like making them more, I mean, in the case of Monster, making them more human, like
and the diggers, and
it's just you know, I always sort of come away from your books thinking about humanity and what
for me that's what they are, they're thinking about humanity, and you take those characters and you pour into them aspects of humanity which make us able to look at them, you know, those traits, those human traits like courage, what courage is. There are two forms of courage in Bili and Jluti. Bili is this, Jluti is very brave and bold and does all of these things. And my question always was as a kid, because I wasn't very brave, I was quite timid, was, is it really brave? If a brave person goes and does something, or a bold person, it's not the step forward that it is for someone like Bealey to do it. Mm. And that therefore, so what is courage actually? And so for Bealey, he's constantly feeling he's not brave, and he really honours his brother Jluti and sees himself as this brave and bold character. And yet it's Bealey who takes the greatest steps. At the same time, Jluti is often in a situation where he knows he's brave and he doesn't feel frightened, but then he sometimes sees this courage of his brother and is knocked out by it. And also he himself has his own challenges of how to deal with things. Like, he doesn't hear as well as Bealey hears, because Bealey is more gentle, Bealey is more humble, Bealey is softer. And because he's softer, he's open to things, he's open in a gentler way to the world, and therefore he might be wiser. Even though Bealey is braver and can do things in a bolder way, and he's very decisive, it's that sometimes that lack of decision, that gentleness, that hesitancy, that allows more knowledge and learning to come. So it's mediating those two kind of characters against one another. And I think also when you're reading to a child, or reading with a child with one of these, and I think that's what parents should do too. I think it's great if a child brings you a book and says, "I really love this book." You should note the honour that you're getting when a child brings a book to you and recommends it. You better read that book, you know, and you better try and figure out what it is that struck that child so much that makes it want to share that book with you. Because isn't it the most special thing? We were talking about this before, sharing a book that you love with someone. I have to say, if I give someone a book that I truly love, I'm very careful about those books that I give. And if I give it to someone and I truly love the book, if the person doesn't like the book, they go down in my estimation, not the book.
I'm so with you on that.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a test.
Yeah. This isn't a book, this is a test.
I very much look forward to, I have two little nieces, they're only one and two, and one of them is a bit of a Jluti and one of them is a bit of a Bealey. The one is known as the wrecking ball.
Yeah.
And the other one is a little bit more cautious.
Yeah.
And I loved in this book how both those character traits are celebrated. And and it not one's not good, one's not bad. They complement each other. Mm. Even from the very beginning,
right,
when Jluti's leaving, he acknowledges how important it is that there's someone at home.
Definitely. Yeah.
Looking after everything.
Yeah. Well, the fact that they're two little boys, two little male characters, is really important to me too. Because we don't move forward into a relationship or anything like that. That's one of the things that definitely marks it a children's book. It's very accessible to kids because it's not... I'm not crazy about books that set that up when they're very young. The idea of... It's all there in fairy tales anyway, and someone else can do that if they want to. But I prefer that period in which you think about being human. I think we could extend that a little bit longer rather than then sexualizing it into boy and girl partner or whatever partnership is going to be. It's better to just stay right away from that and allow them to think about what it is to be human for as long as possible. And because that's in the end what's important, isn't it? Male and female, that's irrelevant compared to what it is to be human and to be a good human being and a good person in the world, whether you're a good, you know, monster or a good Bealey or Jluti or a good digger. Personhood for me is thinking about being and being able to think about your impact on others. That's personhood as I see it. And I think those books allow that kind of conversation. And what you were saying about being able to celebrate those traits, one of the lovely things, just going back to an earlier question about writing through the minds of children, is that children, you can immediately know a child character, whether it's true or not in the world, by the fact that they don't judge as adults do. We judge all the time, but kids don't. And so that lovely moment of being able to immerse yourself in a character that isn't judgmental, that they're trying to understand. I mean, they judge the makers because they're concerned about the effect of the makers, but they also acknowledge they don't know anything about what they're for.
They're willing to learn about it. They want to know more. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're curious, and Bealey's very nervous about... But of course, you know, they all move forward to the moment of why they're there and what they're for and what they decide they're for. Because, you know, it's not just a matter of they're chosen for something. It's that they have a choice whether or not to try to make a difference or not, or whether to just live their own lives, which is okay too. But that's their decision to make in the end and all the rest of it. Oh, I do like those characters.
They are lovely. And you identify with both, I feel. Like, on the face of it, I would say I'm a bit more like Bealey.
Yeah.
But then I have moments with Jluti, like when he's on his journey right at the beginning and he acknowledges that he doesn't know why he likes to be off by himself like that, but he just does. And I'm like, well, I feel that way a lot.
I love that. I love that he could express that, because I felt that very strongly when he was walking across the plain, and it's the day, and he all of the things that he likes are the things that frighten Billy to begin with, and he doesn't know why. And I feel like that joy of, like, for me, being on a mountain and skiing or something, some days you're just up there and you don't know why, but you're just so happy being out there in the elements and all the rest of it. And he just so perfectly expresses sometimes that joy of being alive now. He really can do that, Shruti, I think.
I do love them. They're very cute. And there's a great little inspiration story, which you were telling us before we started the podcast about where the very first idea for them, where it came from.
Well, I was in the Czech Republic, and actually Babička claimed it the other day very strongly. I posted a picture of Billy and Shruti, these two little toy characters that I'd found. And so I should tell the story first. So Babička, my daughter's Czech grandmother, likes to trawl through op shops, Eastern European version of op shops. And me, it's not my favourite thing to do. I mean, I only go to the books, but if you're in an Eastern European shop, you can't really read anything. So I'm just kind of like, I wonder what that is. So there's not a lot of interest for me, because the interest in secondhand shops is books. And so I'm hanging near the front desk waiting for them to go through God knows what, down there in the back digging through boxes. And right next to the counter is this barrel with stuff in it. And on the top are these two little characters, this little yellow creature and this little white creature with a human face, little ears, tail and furry bodies. And I looked and I thought, oh my God, they're so cute. And that they're dirty. And I looked up to the girl and I said in Czech, what are they for? And she said, oh, they're just rubbish. And I said, they're rubbish? And she said, yes, you want, you can have, in English. So I picked up the two, and they were so cute. And I thought, why would anyone throw them away? And it's that whole toy story notion of someone loved them, they must have, and someone drew them the tears and all the rest of it. So I looked at them and thought, oh, I said, can I have them? And she said, yes, yes. And I was standing there with them waiting, and Babička and my daughter Adelaide come to the front, and Babička suddenly says, oh, and she takes them both out of my hand, and she said, two, one for Adelka and one for Clara. And Clara is her very sophisticated seven-year-old cousin. My daughter was three. And so she gives it to Adelaide, and she puts the other one into a handbag, and she gives it to Clara. Clara, you know, puts it on a shelf, never plays with it again. And every time we were at Clara's house, it would kill me to see this little guy there. And we drew Billy, and we played with him, and we took him everywhere. And I just felt I wanted that. I wanted them back together again. So finally I traded two Selena Gomez tapes, three I think, to Clara to get him back and put them back together. And his paw had been chewed off by their dog, and poor little Billy. And so because of their background of how they'd come to us, Billy's always a little bit timid and worried, because he'd had this, you know, period in which he'd been taken away and left alone on the shelf, and a dog ate his paw. So I brought them back together again, and that they came with us to Australia when we came back to Australia, and Adelaide was much older. And, you know, there's toys you never give away, and they were among the toys, but they were always, you know, special. And at some point I realized that I'd finished the little first series and I wanted to draw again, and we'd been drawing those for years, so they were the obvious. And I thought that perhaps the publishers might want to use someone else to do the drawings, but as it transpired, it was me who did them again. So that's their backstory. So I take them around there everywhere with me. You know Crow out of the little first series? So he came too, because he just refuses to be left behind. So he's stuffed with a bent beak he's really complaining about in my suitcase back in the hotel, but Billy and Shruti have come. Someone said to me, Adelaide said to me yesterday, I said, should I take Crow too? She said, no, Billy and Shruti can have a day out without Crow. So Crow said, so he's in the suitcase. But he did get to come. You see how my life is dominated by these creatures. Last time I brought home a puppet, because I collect them for my daughter, she said, Mama, I think it's time we stop pretending that they're for me and we just say they're for you.
No, we're so glad that you found them, because these are just two of the cutest characters
ever. They are.
And your illustrations, I absolutely love them as well. And I found reading them that I would be eager for the next illustration. I was so happy.
It's so nice to hear that. Yeah. Thank you.
Because it just added so much more. And you know, when you read, you create it in your mind. But I love then seeing it. And
we were very careful, like when we were arranging the stories, Marina, who put together both the visuals and designed it all, did such a beautiful job. But we were very careful. I always wanted the visuals to appear after the words, preferably yes. on the next page, so that people would be able to imagine what they wanted before we came to a sort of an illustration of it.
And so, I picked that up as well, that you weren't bringing them before, and I loved that, that it gave me a chance to have that moment to myself.
Thank you for noticing. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell her, well done.
Because we were so, it's really actually amazingly hard to lay out the lines and make sure. And she was just so good at finding a way to make it work.
It is. It's good placement. Because I noticed that as well. And it's like a little echo. You've got it in your head already. And then you turn the page and you're like, and there they are. And then, you know. I love the visuals in this book. Like, just the thought of them pulling that. Through the snow. Yeah.
That's what I'd love to. I'd love to see it translated into visuals because I could just so imagine them pulling that
and
little thing along.
And red flying overhead with them, and you get a bird's eye view. Like that, it was playing in my mind the whole time as a movie. And
you
the
are. I love you too. I love how you read.
We will
get
be
it all. Like, you make me feel so competent.
Yeah. Well, you are. I mean, and
that's not in question.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, I don't read many kids' books, and as even though they're written. You know, and you could read these to children. I think they mean so much to
adults. I really wanted that. I wanted it so that if an adult read any of the Little Fur books or any of these, that it would be... I didn't want a book that had a kind of a wink and a nudge to an adult. I didn't want that. I don't like these kinds of books, and I didn't want that. But I wanted it to be beautiful and complex enough. Because, like I said before, just because a child sees something and doesn't have the language for it doesn't mean to say their view of the world or their grief or their sorrow or their concern is any less complex and layered than ours. In fact, it might even be stronger what they feel. But their ability to say what they're seeing is just the only thing that's the difference. Yeah. And I really tried to say that in those books in the hope that an adult reading it would still feel all those layering that you would want in anything you read, that they would still get it as well.
Absolutely. When I read it, it doesn't feel like it was written for a child and I'm an adult not meaning to be reading this. It feels like it was written for me as much as
for that's what I want. Yeah. I want it to be...
Have that feeling. Yeah. But you also really want to read it to a child.
Yes. I wish I had a little cousin that I could read it, but I don't.
Because you said before something about names and things, when you say them, they shouldn't sound right, but they do. But the sound of words is really, really important to me. And I think it's because I told stories out loud first, that I think you can still tell in everything I've written that in even the books that are much older, that I was first an oral storyteller and the sound of words is really important. And so that desire to read things aloud, I loved reading things aloud that sounded beautiful, like The Mouse and His Child. Have you ever read that?
No.
Oh my God, you have to. You will love it, both of you. But The Mouse and His Child, or some books like Philip Pullman we were talking about before, his books read aloud. There are sections that you just have a desire to say them out loud. I mean, I do read things out loud sometimes if I like them enough, just to see what they sound like. And I think, again, that's one of the things that I hope makes people like reading it out loud as well to children.
Well, it does. It definitely has that one. It is meant to be read out loud, and it has this so... It's so beautiful, everything about it, not just the words, but the story and the setting, that you can just... When I was reading it, I was almost imagining it like a beautiful old fairy tale that it has to be passed on and it has to be read in this kind of deep...
You described
mystery
it.
Running through
there has to be, doesn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can just imagine it being one of these things that if it was, you know, made into a movie or something, that would have this beautiful, deep male voice over the top, sort of narrating it. That's kind of the sounds that I had.
You definitely have to listen to the Philip Pullman.
Okay.
Like, you will love them so much.
Yeah,
what
really,
are your books?
They sound great. And And
you will thank me, both of you.
Okay.
You'll thank me.
We might
me.
Just have to
That's
do that right
gift.
Now. I'm just so looking forward to it because these are the first of your books that Ron's read. And now I'm like, right, we've got to get you through all of them so then we can talk about all
Absolutely.
Of them.
I think that's going to have to happen.
Next time we'll be talking about what you read in the
That's it. Yeah. Isabel, thank you so much for coming and chatting to us. That
such
was
a pleasure.
It was
a pleasure.
So lovely. And
I tell you, last time it was like the perfect celebration of a new book coming out, and this is, you know, this is just the same. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you can get all of Isabel Carmody's books at Booktopia at www.booktopia.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV.
And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.